Happy 4th of July. Thanks for joining us for the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We'll discuss and debate the top stories in state and national politics this hour with two guests from different perspectives. And we'll welcome your views on the issues that you would like on the docket. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Lots to talk about today. We'll talk about the Hobby Lobby decision from the Supreme Court. We'll talk about executive orders and President Obama telling Congress to go ahead and sue him. We'll talk about Wisconsin reportedly taking a look at changing its civil service system and also possibly selling some public property. So that and whatever else you want to talk about on the docket today, let's welcome our guests. Kevin Hermaning, a financial planner in Wausau and a political activist. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy, and happy Independence Day to you.
Yes, happy 4th of July. Also joining us is Tony Palmieri, a professor of communications at UW Oshkosh, media columnist for the Fox Valley Scene. Hello, Tony.
Good morning, Joy, and happy Independence Day to you and Kevin.
Well, what is, do you have a 4th of July tradition, Tony? Are you going to fire up the grill later or anything?
Yeah, probably. You just did that show on hot dogs.
So. Now I'm in the mood for a hot dog.
Hopefully the veggie kind, like you prefer.
Right. Kevin, how about you? Any 4th of July weekend plans for you?
Well, the 4th usually involves some golf, and you're right, some grilling out. The hot dog show also reminded me that when I believe I was 13 or 14, trying to, quote, earn my way to a new Little League uniform, it was a hot dog eating contest, and I didn't quite win.
Well, I didn't know that. Well, we can try again today then for that. We'll have a patriotic 4th of July themed Week in Review quiz question coming up a little bit later in the program. Well, you know, I want to talk about first, and starting with Kevin, because Kevin is a financial planner. We just heard in the news about strong news about the U.S. economy yesterday, helping the Dow top 17,000 for the first time ever. And I'm reading that there's apparently no immediate end in sight to this strong stock market. What's going on here, Kevin?
Well, my opinion is that as companies continue to gradually hire people back, they've continued to remain very profitable because the number one cost to any business is its labor and benefit expense. And with all of the layoffs that occurred 6-7 years ago, right up until a few years ago, and some companies are still struggling, there's no question about it. Regulatory costs and such in certain industries have definitely been a burden. But overall, we've seen companies be very profitable, and that is what drives the prices of corporate America stocks. And it's not just in the U.S., it's also abroad. Most of the major market indices around the world, Joy, have actually experienced all-time record highs, though I would note that there is one notable laggard, and that is the NASDAQ Composite Index, which is still a full 15% below, almost 17% below where it was way back in March of 2000. So the tech-laden and small retailers and pharmaceutical type company indices and the big techs definitely have lagged the overall market. But the job creation numbers are definitely getting better, and that is good news not only for Wall Street but also for Main Street.
Yeah, well, I guess, Tony, you're not going to disagree with that.
I think the best part of the jobs report was the fact that the unemployment rate went down not because of people giving up and leaving the workforce, but or just giving up looking, but because people are actually getting jobs. But for us as Wisconsinites, the problem continues to be that we are lagging behind the rest of the nation. So as we get closer to an election here in our state, I think the issue will be the state economy and how it's fared under our present governor rather than what's happening at the national level. It seems like we are just well behind the national average in job growth, and I think someone needs to be held accountable for that.
You know, why are we behind in job growth, Kevin?
Well, actually, it's typical that those types of economies around the country that had not lost quite as much are going to be the ones that are slower coming back, and those that lost the most are going to be the ones that come whipping back the fastest because there was more to recover from. We definitely saw a lot of job loss from about 2007 to 2009. 2010 and 11, we were not even in the ballpark as far as seeing any job recovery. There's no doubt, however, that we've seen some of the strongest job growth in probably, in fact, I looked at the number, it was about 8 or 9 years ago that we've seen this type of job growth. And so I think that if Tony and others, Mary Burke and others, want to make job creation and the economy in the state of Wisconsin the keystone issue of this fall's election, I would say that the election results are going to definitely be on the red side.
Mm-hmm. Tony?
The fact is the governor said that he'd create 250,000 jobs. He's not even close to that in spite of the fact that he was given his entire agenda by the legislature. We're now living under the Walker austerity agenda, and it has not worked. We're lagging behind every other state in the Midwest. We're lagging nationally, and you know the governor cannot continue to blame Jim Doyle or Barack Obama. He's gotten everything he's wanted from the legislature, and we're still lagging behind. So we'll see what the voters say come November, but the governor has not even come close to meeting that promise of 250,000 new jobs.
You know, I was going to talk about this later in the hour, but since we're on the gubernatorial campaign, Democratic candidate Mary Burke hit the road on her campaign bus this weekend, and she's headed to northern Wisconsin. So, Kevin, you're kind of sort of in northern Wisconsin in Wausau. What will you tell her at her campaign stop? What are the issues important to northern Wisconsin?
Well, one thing I would definitely advise Mary Burke is to not try to get in the way of one of the few companies in central and northern Wisconsin that has seen some promising opportunities for people to find great quality jobs. That is to not stand in the way of the mine. Voters in northern Wisconsin want to see mining. They believe that the mining can be done in a safe, environmentally sound manner with regulatory oversight. There's no doubt that the DNR has a responsibility, but the idea that we're going to go back to the jobs killing agenda of high regulatory expenses, of a higher tax burden on small businesses, and small businesses represent about 90% of all employers in northern Wisconsin, and about 50% of all people employed. And so, you know, you're looking at a situation where small businesses are going to be the growth engine that is going to continue to bring people online into the jobs environment and to build economic opportunities for their families and their communities. I think it's just a losing proposition. One of the biggest challenges that Mary Burke has in central and northern Wisconsin is that people don't know who she is. But this is not uncommon. We're not even through the summer, and the voters are definitely not tuning in yet. This is a proposition that doesn't really begin until Labor Day. And yes, from Labor Day until Election Day, things get very busy, very heated. The airways are of course clogged with political advertisements. And she'll have an opportunity to get her message out. I just don't think it's a winning message.
Yeah. Well, Mary Burke last Friday told Wisconsin Public Radio, was asked about the mine, and she said, "I will certainly look at every tool that I have and to make sure that we are protecting our natural resources. Our air, our water are so important, not only to the people who live in the community, but to the tourism industry as well." And the Burke campaign clarified her comments, saying that she's not saying she's going to try to stop the GTAC mine, but that the GTAC mine should not proceed if it's going to harm the environment in any way, in essence. Tony, your thoughts on the mine as an issue in the gubernatorial campaign?
Well, basically what she's saying is that she'd prefer that the laws that existed before the current legislature changed them should be in place, which would in effect make it much, much more difficult for that mine to happen. I think the ground she's staking out on the mine is one that would have wide levels of support across the state of Wisconsin, including in the north. People do not want to see our environmental resources wrecked to benefit a private company, an out-of-state company. And when we see laws changed in order to benefit that one company, that's troubling. So I don't think the mining issue is will make or break Burke's chances to win the governorship. I mean, I think the jobs issue will be number one, and also education. When it came out recently that only the state of Alabama has had more cuts to education than Wisconsin over the last few years, that's pretty troubling. And when Kevin talks about small business job growth, I agree with him completely. But a key part of small business job growth is having an educated workforce. And why, at the very same time we're trying to grow small business and allow conditions for it to succeed, would we be having those kinds of education cuts? It just makes no sense. So I think if Burke hammers on those themes, I think she's got a real strong shot of winning the race in November.
You want to comment on the education issue, Kevin?
Well, Tony has chosen a very narrow part of a broad survey to suggest that Wisconsin has slashed education spending. The truth of the matter is that the education budget in the state of Wisconsin is bigger today than on the day that Governor Walker took office. He may not appreciate, and a lot of other people may not appreciate, where those dollars have gone, but more money has gone into the classrooms for the first time in a long time, into direct support of children and curricula than we've seen in 30 years over the past two to four years. But, you know, Tony mentioned earlier the 250,000 job creation pledge that Scott Walker made. And those of us on the conservative side cringed at the very idea that you would make such a concrete commitment. I welcomed the transparency. I welcomed the idea that he was going to be fervent in his support for job creation. But there are so many forces that are far outside the control of an individual, a chief executive, especially in a global economic meltdown, that were far out of his control. Tony, you and I both know that the governor really only in the last 2 years, not even 2 years, has been able to get his agenda implemented. And the first 2 years were, for all intents and purposes, wasted, not wasted opportunities, but wasted because of the recall process. And when the governor was first elected, he didn't have overall total control of all branches of government, in the sense that we saw unanimity in the state Senate. There were many times where the governor's agenda was not implemented by the legislature as a whole. And so trying to infer that this $250,000 jobs pledge is all the governor's fault, again, he needs to be held accountable for that. It is part of the political process. He and his allies, such as myself, we are required to try to respond to people who criticize the fact that 250,000 new jobs have not been created in Wisconsin in the last 4 years. But there are a lot of other factors that were playing a role in that, and we'll see how the voters respond. Most of the polls I've seen suggest that they understand, the average voter understands, that the first year and a half to 2 years were not even really a real opportunity for any elected official in this state.
Got to take a break. Kevin Hermaning is with us, a financial planner in Wausau, also a political activist. And Tony Palmieri, a professor of communications at UW Oshkosh and media columnist for the Fox Valley Scene. We are talking about the top state and national news stories of the week during this edition of the Week in Review, and we welcome your input on the top stories of the week. Coming up next, I think we'll talk about that Hobby Lobby decision and its ramifications. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can comment on the issues we're talking about, or you can introduce a news story from the week that you would like us to talk about on the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. This This is our 4th of July edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives. Today we are talking with Kevin Hermaning and Tony Palmieri, and you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court this week issuing this decision in the Hobby Lobby case. The justices say that the U.S. cannot make certain employers cover certain forms of contraception if it violates religious beliefs of those employers. Let's get Tony to react first to this Supreme Court ruling.
I think that Justice Ginsburg and her dissent, which has now been just widely circulated, you know, dissents usually don't get that much wide attention, but she used the line that the court has ventured into a minefield here, and I think that's accurate. We're going to see probably many organizations come out with a host of objections based on religious belief. I mean, she cited some examples in her dissent, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses who don't believe in blood transfusions and Scientologists who don't believe in antidepressants. I mean, the list can, on religious grounds, I mean, the list can go on and on and on. And what also was a little bit disturbing to me was in the majority opinion written by Justice Alito, he addresses Ginsburg's dissent extensively and says that this really isn't a problem because the feds have in place a process whereby a company like Hobby Lobby can simply fill out a form, express their religious objection, and then a third party will cover the contraceptive cost, be it the insurer or another third party. And then a few days later, the Supreme Court grants an injunction to prevent Wheaton College from having to fill out that form. They don't even want to fill out the form. So on the one hand, the court is saying this form is available. Then a few days later, they say, but we're going to prevent even that form from being filled out as it works its way through the court. So it's somewhat confusing what the court is doing, but I do think that Ginsburg's comment about the minefield is one that is really spot on and will come back to haunt the court and the nation as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, is this a minefield?
I don't think so. First of all, this is actually a very narrow ruling. It's not some broad brush rebuke of the president's effort to require companies to do or to do things that they don't want to do on any ground in any circumstance. This, considering that only four of the 20 contraceptives were even part of the case. And it's only for those drugs that would terminate already fertilized eggs, the viability of already fertilized eggs. That's really what this was about. But you know what's interesting is that people, they want to criticize the five male justices for their decision, and yet they ignore that way back in 1993, it was President Bill Clinton who signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And people don't think about this or remember this. I recall because I was involved very much in some active political activities at that time in support of, well, not only as a candidate just prior to that, but also involved in some organizations that were advocating for certain political positions on public policy. The vote was passed in the House of Representatives on a voice vote, but a vote of 97-3 in the U.S. Senate. And people don't remember that this was based on the peyote case from those two Native Americans, I believe in the state of Oregon, and they simply wanted to advocate for what they wanted as part of their religious ceremony. And of course, they were subsequently denied unemployment benefits by the state of Oregon because they were in violation of the law. And so the president at that time, the so-called leader of the Democrat Party in many circles even today, Bill Clinton, was the one who actually laid the groundwork for this law to take place, for this Supreme Court decision to take place. So, and not only do I think it was a sound decision and it rewards freedom of religious freedom on very narrow grounds in this case, but it goes way back. This is a 21-year case in the making based on laws that were a law that was passed by a very bipartisan, a rare bipartisan effort in Washington.
Well, we have callers. Let's go to Dave in Wanakee. Hello, Dave.
Yes, hello. I found the Hobby Lobby decision to be very hypocritical on the part of the owners of Hobby Lobby and obtuse on the part of the majority decision, in that the their heartfelt beliefs that women shouldn't be allowed to obtain abortions through these drugs is only heartfelt as long as it doesn't cost them anything. They are perfectly fine with investing in those companies, those drug companies that make those drugs. So I wonder how deep is that heartfelt belief, and why didn't the Supreme Court consider that?
Do you know why, Kevin?
Well, first of all, that wasn't at all part of the case. I think the caller is mistaken, at least in one area, and that is whether he finds the views of the owners of Hobby Lobby to be hypocritical or not is not really the issue. The issue is, why should any private employer be forced to pay for something with which they fundamentally disagree as a matter of an employee's benefit package? They nonetheless still do provide, through the payment of health care benefits for their employees, reproductive rights opportunities for 16 of the 20 women's reproductive rights pills and devices. And so this is a very narrow case that I think has not generated as much controversy across the country as those on the left would purport. Mm-hmm. This is a political whipping boy. Sandra Fluck, in her Washington Post op-ed on Monday, was way offline. And Tony, I think you were off base earlier when you suggested that this goes into blood transfusions and a whole bunch of other areas. This has nothing to do with that. This is a very narrow case that only limits does not force private employers to pay for reproductive rights for women for just four of the 20 things that they might want to use.
Tony.
Well, it's not off base. I mean, Justice Ginsburg was making the point, which I think is an excellent one and probably a common sense point, that this decision opens up the floodgates to literally any employer claiming a religious reason for objecting to any law, is essentially what she was saying. I mean, I could see the courts being flooded with this. I think, you know, Dave, the caller, makes a good point. Hobby Lobby, in their retirement investment fund, does have investment in some of the very products that they now oppose in this case. But one thing I want to correct is the idea that these four contraceptives are somehow abortion drugs. There's widespread consensus in the medical community that these are not abortion drugs by any stretch of the imagination. One of them, the Plan B, does not work if a woman is pregnant. It does not terminate a pregnancy. It prevents a pregnancy. In fact, what is so odd about this is that by preventing or by making it more difficult to receive contraceptive services, basically the chances for abortion are increased. I mean, I think everybody agrees that one way to reduce abortions is to make sure contraception is readily available in an inexpensive way. So, I mean, in an odd, paradoxical kind of way, Hobby Lobby might actually be increasing the chance of abortions going up.
We have a follow-up to the Supreme Court decision involving Hobby Lobby. The Atlantic this week is reporting that following the Hobby Lobby ruling, a group of religious leaders wrote a letter to President Obama asking to be exempted from a pending executive order that would prohibit federal contractors from discriminating against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in hiring practices. So, Tony, is this the minefield of which you speak?
I mean, that's the start of the minefield. I mean, I expect we'll be seeing many more letters and requests like that. Please exempt us from federal law because of our religious belief. The Supreme Court has now opened the door to this kind of thing, and I think we're going to be seeing much more of it over the next few years.
Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to that letter, or reported letter, Kevin?
Well, there have also been a lot of religious organizations and publications which have praised the Hobby Lobby decision. But I would just simply say, to paint a broader brush and say this, there has been nobody who has provided more exemptions to more laws under different circumstances than the current chief executive in the White House.
Yeah. You know, we should move on to some other issues since we have many others to cover. Lots of callers interested in this Hobby Lobby case. But since we just touched on a pending executive order prohibiting discrimination against based on sexual orientation, the president kind of got into it with Congress, maybe specifically Speaker John Boehner, this week when he said, Congress isn't doing anything. If Congress isn't going to do anything to help the middle class, I am. So sue me. So John Boehner says he wants to sue President Obama for his use of executive action, saying that he's overstepping his bounds. Do you think he's overstepping his bounds, President Obama, that is, starting with Tony?
I don't particularly like the use of executive actions by any president, no matter what political party that they're from. But I think President Obama makes a point here that's a sound one. This Congress has set out from the beginning to frustrate his entire agenda. But not only that, it seems like nothing happens. And the president announced that this was going to be the year of action. I don't think he's going to sit back and just allow nothing to happen. The lawsuit seems laughable. Although, you know, if something like this were to reach this current Supreme Court with its current makeup, who knows what could happen. But I'm wondering, why just sue the president? I mean, why doesn't Boehner and the Republican majority, why don't they just pursue the impeachment procedure? You know, I think that would be something. What a spectacle that would be to see a Congress that refuses to budge on just about every core issue facing the nation, to then try and sue and maybe even impeach the president for trying to do something. I think in the public eye, the president wins that battle.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think that anytime somebody starts a sentence or ends a sentence by saying, however, or but, they're really suggesting that the first part of what they've said has no merit whatsoever. The idea that Tony is suggesting that he is opposed to executive orders as a matter of routine then fails to hold up when he says, but this president in this case, in all of these cases, is doing the right thing because he's trying to better the country. Tony, you don't have a corner on what, quote, bettering the country is all about. And I really think that the president is failing to understand the role of the chief executive, which is to lead, to instill confidence in the American people as well as in his fellow elected officials in the White House, in the Congress. And the White House has really not. The president was elected on the premise, and all the media held him up as to be this great unifier. And even Jonathan Turley, the law professor in Washington, D.C., has, and no conservative by any stretch of the imagination, has joined with conservatives in slamming this president's use of executive power. I would note, however, to be fair, this president has not yet, at least not yet, put in place as many executive orders as Bill Clinton or as George W. Bush. Now, this is through June 20th. In fact, this president has put in exactly half as many executive orders so far as Bill Clinton did. Now, of course, he still has two more years to go, but the 182 executive orders that the president has issued, unfortunately, have rarely been just a simple assessment of how current legislation and how current public policy might be implemented. He's actually used his executive orders to undo and rewrite actual legislation of the Congress. And that's why I believe it's 12 times now the Supreme Court has ruled 9-0 against the president on his use of executive orders and a number of other areas. And I think that John Boehner will win the current lawsuit that he's decided to put forth. Impeachment is a last resort in almost every case, in all cases, in my view. And so the idea that Congress would pursue impeachment proceedings at this point, when they have other forms of recourse, I believe is a much better option.
Let me take a call. Lynn in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Lynn.
Yeah, hi. I mean, the gentleman who just got done speaking, I mean, it's just ludicrous. Ludicrous conversation. I mean, the Congress has refused to work with the president on almost anything because, as Mitch McConnell said, you know, they wanted him to be a one-term president. They want him to fail. This, if there is no compromise, even when Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the House, there were differences with Ronald Reagan, but there was an ability to compromise. Now, what is the different factor here? One could speculate on what is the issue where there is absolutely no room for compromise with the president. So what they would prefer to do is hold everything up and then say, see, he did nothing. Well, if he tried to do something, see, we're going to sue him. I think conservatives and Republicans should be wary because you can win the battle but lose the war. And the as far as 2016, people are looking at Hobby Lobby. They're looking at how Congress interacts. And it doesn't look appealing to have a Republican president.
Well, we haven't heard from Tony, so let me have Tony bring it back on this one.
Well, I think Lynn makes a great point. I mean, the Congress has refused to work with Obama on just about every single issue. Kevin acknowledges executive orders are common. I mean, they've been used throughout the history of the country. I don't think every president has been sued for using them. What the Congress should do, if we want to talk about leadership, is Mr. Boehner should come forward and announce an intention to work with the president to tackle some of the core issues facing the country. I mean, immigration seems to be the one that's setting off a lot of firestorm on executive action right now. But I think Lynn is correct. I mean, if you've got a branch of government, in this case the legislature, whose majority position is that we want the president to fail, what at that point would any president do? You know, he's got to find a way to act. If the legislative branch will not work with him. And again, there is precedent for it. I mean, pretty much every president in the history of the country has used executive orders, for better or worse.
Yeah. And Lynn thinks Republicans are going to be hurt by this. Kevin, your thoughts on that?
Well, we clearly have a split country. Although the majority of the state houses are run by Republicans, the majority of governors in the United States are Republicans. So there clearly is a big Republican sentiment across the U.S. It's just the big urban areas and the larger states with the majority or a lot of electoral votes, i.e. members of the House, tend to get a lot of the publicity. The leaders are from large states with large populations. And on the Democrat side, I'm talking about Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, and you get people like Chuck Schumer. By the way, Chuck Schumer was one of the authors of that Religious Freedom Act back in 1993. I don't think that Chuck Schumer is a conservative Republican by any stretch, but I don't believe that this the Hobby Lobby bill is going to fire up a quarter of 1% of the liberal base in 2016. The 2016 election is not going to revolve around what happened last week Monday in the U.S. Supreme Court. The 2016 election is going to revolve around the security of the United States, the wasted opportunity in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria, what's going on the borders to the south of the United States. Isn't it ironic that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, cares more about the borders of Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan than he does about our own southern border? It's a sad testament when we hear on Independence Day and we think about what happened 250 years ago, have to now be witnessing the invasion of our country by people who are bringing death and disease to the U.S. And all the idea that what we really need to be concerned about are the children. Who's concerned about the children right now?
And I'm sure Tony wants to maybe respond to that. We're past break time, so let's be brief. The president did sign an executive order to ease deportations. He's under pressure to crack down on the tide of Central American children entering the U.S. without their parents. Tony.
I just don't understand how Kevin or anyone can claim it's the president who doesn't care about the borders when the Congress has announced they won't do anything on immigration. And who really is it that doesn't care about the borders when you have a branch of government that says we're not going to do anything? I think those are the folks who don't care.
Yeah. Tony, the Republicans are the ones who want to enforce the border laws. They want to put up the fence. I loved what Charles Krauthammer, the columnist and anchor, the columnist said earlier this week, or asked the question, if fences don't work, then why do we have one around the White House?
Everyone knows we need immigration reform. The Congress has announced there will be no reform. They are the ones who are showing little concern for what goes on at that border. They will not act.
Coming up, we are going to have our Week in Review quiz, and we'll talk about other national and state issues in the news this week. I think based on the clock, we should turn to some state issues. Talk about a controversy over the Walker administration looking at ways to streamline the hiring for state jobs, looking at the civil service system in Wisconsin. Anything wrong with this? That and more coming up as our Week in Review continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. On this Independence Day, we have a very patriotic quiz question. Yesterday, the Library of Congress hosted a special concert to mark the 200th anniversary of the writing of the Star-Spangled Banner. However, our national anthem was not always called the Star-Spangled Banner. What was its original name? 1-800-642-1234. Call in if you know or if you'd like to guess. 1-800-642-1234. What was the original name of the United States National Anthem? You can also email us, talk@wpr.org. We'll give you about 5 minutes to call in your answer. We'll randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and the winner will be awarded a fabulous prize. We'll have the winner and the answer at the end of today's program. Again, what was the original name of the United States National Anthem? Francis Scott Key penned it 200 years ago this year. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking today to Tony Palmieri, who is a professor of communications at UW-Oshkosh, a media columnist for the Fox Valley Scene, and Kevin Hermaning, who is a financial planner in Wausau and a political activist. Let's talk a little bit about some state issues in terms of a story that's in the news. We will follow up on our state capitol report on Monday. State Representative Peter Barka very concerned that the Walker administration is looking into streamlining civil hires, the civil service system. And Kevin Hermaning, do you see anything wrong with changing our civil service system?
My understanding of the reading of the proposals and in the interviews that the administration officials have spoken about are that they weren't looking at actually upending the civil service system. We're looking at reducing some of the red tape, the protections that obviously union officials think are, and have always operated as safeguards against political patronage. But what's interesting is that these aren't the type of things that are going to take place over the course of the next couple of months. There are going to be opportunities for people like Peter Barka and some of the others who are so concerned about any change at all to protecting their union buddies in the hiring process for state jobs. I think that what we're going to likely see is a very slow move to streamline some of the hiring process, the interviews, process, the reality about whether or not all of the jobs that presently exist, which are filled by people for decades, Whereas in the private sector, companies have sought to streamline and reposition and put into different jobs simply because they were hired into a job. I remember being on the school board in Mozambique for 10 years, and we had somebody who, as late as the year 2000, was still pushing around a film strip cart because that's what this person was hired to do 27 years earlier. And in this day of the internet, you would think that that position could have been changed, but the job was, quote, protected. And it made it very hard for the administrators and the executives of the school district, which are the elected officials, the school board members, to actually do their job efficiently for taxpayers and kids.
Yeah, apparently, according to the AP story, Governor Walker's administration is looking at ways to streamline the hiring for state jobs to help cope with a looming wave of retirements. But State Representative Peter Barca is concerned that that there's not a really open process. The public needs to have a full and open discussion as to whatever changes are being considered. Tony, your thoughts on this?
Here's the thing. When the Walker administration undermined the collective bargaining protections for state workers, a huge part of their argument was we really don't need collective bargaining protections because we have a strong civil service system. So now we find out that it sounds to me like a fairly active attempt to maybe weaken civil service protections. What's disturbing about this story, Joy and Kevin, is that the only reason why we even know that this discussion is taking place is because an open records request had to be filed. So we've got lack of transparency. We have a governor who ran in 2010 telling us he didn't want to undermine unions. He just wanted to be a tougher negotiator. And it seems like we're seeing the same process now playing out with civil service. The DOA Secretary Hipsch is now saying, oh, no, we just want to help streamline the hiring. We're not really going to weaken our laws. Who can believe this administration after what we went through in 2010? So I think that to get back to the election issue, Mary Burke should make this a strong issue. We had our collective bargaining laws drastically rewritten on the argument that we've got strong civil service, and now we've got to make sure that we have some of the strongest civil service laws in the country. So I think Peter Barca is very correct in being concerned about the way this is being brought about.
In other news, the State Department of Administration is putting together a list of state properties that could end up for sale. And Democratic State Senator Fred Risser is concerned about this. Should we be selling state property, Tony?
I think what Risser is concerned about and what all citizens should be concerned about is that on that list are things like heating and cooling facilities, and there could be a scenario where the state sells them to a private entity and then they get leased back to the state. So that would be horrible, obviously, for taxpayers. So that needs to be really monitored very, very closely. I think Risser is correct to be concerned.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Actually, I think it's one of the last things that Tony just said, that it would be terrible for taxpayers if this happened. Actually, I think it would be one of the best things for taxpayers if it happened, that some of these properties might be leased back to the state, because at least then you have choice in the process. The government is involved in a whole lot of things that tend to compete with the private sector. The private sector almost always tends to do things. In fact, I would say I can't think of anything that the government does better than the private sector when it comes to holding down costs, holding employees accountable, protecting the resources of the company. The government doesn't have a very good track record of doing any of those things. And so, you know, there's going to be a lot of gnashing of teeth about whether one item or one property or one parcel of land or a hangar at the Dane County Airport should or shouldn't go, should or shouldn't be sold by the state. But we all know that there was a lot of conflict and controversy a few years back when the state of Wisconsin owned a whole bunch of airplanes. And so it seems like Tony's maybe changed his tune.
Let me move on to another story. The Wisconsin Revenue Department reported this week that tax collections for the first 11 months of the current fiscal year were down by 0.4% from the previous year. So it looks like we may end this year with a slight deficit with the or the new state budget might end with a slight deficit. Republican Governor Scott Walker said that he is not overly concerned. He predicted that his latest tax cut approved could end up stimulating the economy. A spokesperson for Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mary Burke called the tax breaks an election year spending spree based on what the Burke camp calls rosy assumptions. So what about this, Kevin?
Well, Joy, anyone who's been paying attention to economic news across the United States, including in our state, knows that the gross domestic product numbers nationally for the first quarter of this year were abysmal. There's no surprise that, especially in a state which was hindered by terrible cold weather, the Arctic blasts that we all lived under for, it seems it only ended a few weeks ago, took its toll on economic activity and economic growth in this country. A 0.4% differential in the expected tax revenues is a pretty small cost. It no doubt is going to become a political weapon. It needs to be because that's what politics is all about. There's no question about the fact that we're seeing an impact. When you look at the dollar amount, $46 million is a lot of money. But 0.4% in an $11.5 billion budget is a pretty small differential. And it's in line with what's happened elsewhere in the United States.
Tony?
You know, it seems like Scott Walker's supporters on most issues, but especially the economy, use a kind of like what I'll call heads I win, tails you lose approach. If something good happens in our economy, it's because of what the governor does. If something bad happens, it's because of Barack Obama or other outside forces. I mean, at what point are they going to admit that this governor's policies just don't work or are challenged? I mean, I think Burke called it right. The governor came up with all these rosy assumptions justifying his election year tax cut, and those assumptions don't play out. So I think it's just one more bad policy choice from the Walker administration.
All right, well,
Tony, I certainly did not equate Barack Obama and his policies with Mother Nature. The president might try to control the climate, but I don't think he really has much control over it.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there because we are out of time, except to say congratulations to Vicky from Prentice, who is the winner of this week's Week in Review quiz. We asked, what was the original name of the United States National Anthem? And the answer is Defense of Fort McHenry. The melody was actually started off as an English tavern song, and this I didn't know. The Star Spangled Banner's melody is an English tavern song, Anacreon in Heaven. And listen to this English pub song.
To Anacreon in Heaven, where he sat in full glee. A few sons of harmony sent a petition that.
All right, that's enough of that. So it's the 200th anniversary of the Star Spangled Banner. Thanks very much to Vicky, and congratulations for winning. And I guess we'll leave it there. Kevin Hermaning, Tony Palmieri, I hope you both have a very happy 4th of July holiday weekend.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
Thank you, Joy. Same to both of you. Have a great day.
You too. Kevin Hermaning and Tony Palmieri with us for the Week in Review. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Robin Cherry for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.